540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Linda Kenyon. Israel gave Palestinians in Gaza an extension to leave ahead of a planned ground invasion, but that window of opportunity is about to expire. CBS's MTS Tayeb reports from Jerusalem.
Chaos and carnage on the streets. This is a genocide, not a war, this man says. On Friday, Israel blanketed northern Gaza with leaflets telling the 1.1 million people living in the densely populated area to evacuate. An order the UN has described as impossible and would trigger a humanitarian catastrophe. Some did follow Israel's order to move, many fleeing on foot. Most are women and children, but it's a move which cost some of them their lives. According to Hamas, 70 people were killed in this Israeli airstrike that hit a convoy of families fleeing Gaza City.
These Palestinians spoke about the situation in Gaza.
They took from us the electricity and the internet, the water, the food.
My name is Dunya Abrahma. I'm 22 years old. We hope that we will have our simple rights to at least have a home and a house.
As for Americans trying to get out of Gaza,
we just received a statement from a White House official saying our efforts to assist U.S. civilians wanting to leave Gaza are active and ongoing, and the situation remains fluid.
That's CBS's Christina Ruffini at the White House. CBS's Scott Pelley spoke with President Biden this week about the conflict between Israel and Hamas.
To those holding American hostages in Gaza, you say what?
I say we're going to do everything in our power to find them, everything in our power. And I'm not going to go into the detail of that, but we're working like hell on it.
The interview will air on CBS's 60 Minutes tomorrow night. The House of Representatives remains at a standstill as majority Republicans take their search for a new speaker into another week.
With Louisiana's Steve Scalise out, Ohio's Jim Jordan is back in, trying to become the next speaker of the House. But it's unclear if he has enough fellow Republicans to vote for him to make it. He needs 217. As for the opposition,
we want to find a bipartisan path to reopening the House of Representatives.
Democratic Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York with advice for his Republican colleagues.
Break away from the extremism, partner with Democrats on an enlightened bipartisan path forward.
This is CBS News.
You need to hire? Indeed is with you every step of the way, helping you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. There's a new push to encourage women to get screened for breast cancer when they're younger. Eric Tegedoff has more.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and health professionals say younger women are increasingly being diagnosed with the cancer. About 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed in her lifetime, but survival rates are high if the cancer is caught early. Dr. Monica Wells with Kaiser Permanente says 50 is a well-known age for people to start getting screened for the cancer.
If you sample individuals, even amongst my patient population, they think about 50 as being the time they need to start getting mammograms. But what we're doing is we're wanting to move the needle on that and have those conversations earlier.
About 1 in 11 new breast cancer cases are diagnosed to women younger than 45. There are more than 3.8 million breast cancer survivors in the United States. Wells says it might be a good idea for some women to start the screening process at age 40.
If we can identify who we can screen earlier and find those early cases, we sort of have a potentially 10-year head start on treating cancer.
When breast cancer is caught at its earliest stage, the 5-year survival rate is 99%. Wells says that's another reason why screening women at a younger age is important.
Early detection, when we find those cancers that are in their earlier stages, opens up a whole spectrum of treatment options that might not be as readily available or maybe more complicated if it's a more advanced cancer.
I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Have you noticed bad behavior has become normalized at interscholastic athletic events? Some fans seem angry. They lack civility toward one another. Some even get aggressive and unruly. Time out! What is going on? This has to stop. Let's not forget, school sports aren't just about winning. And they're definitely not an excuse to take your frustrations out on the official or the opponent. They're about teaching lessons like perseverance, respect, and empathy, so students can learn and grow as people, not just as players. We all have a role to play in setting a good example for our students and teaching them these important values. So fans, it's time to step up your game and behave positively at interscholastic athletic events in Wisconsin.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, October 14th, 2023. This is Morning Cannolis on the broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin. This is our 67th broadcast coming to you this morning from downtown Waukesha. I am joined in the studios this morning, as always, by my fantastic producer, Anya, who's with me today to take your calls, your questions, your comments, perspectives. That number, of course, 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. Also taking your comments and questions, perspectives by text, by messages to Anya and me. Go to Civic Media Online, find the broadcast station through which you hear this show, and pull down our menu, the Morning Cannolis menu, and send us some information about thoughts that you have this morning on the many topics we're going to be discussing. This is, as always, our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion of those most important news stories in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America, also occasionally, including this morning, overseas as well. We always ask three questions. We always ask, what do we know? What do we know about the facts going on out there? What happened? Why are those things important? Why are they relevant? Why are they significant to our lives, our livelihoods here in the United States and as citizens of the world? And what, if anything, can we and should we be doing in response to those important things happening in our lives? What actions, what responses, what answers should we offer up to those events and circumstances in our lives? Those questions, again, especially important this morning as we undertake a very aggressive but achievable syllabus. We're going to begin by chatting this morning a bit about overseas and specifically the conflict, the war going on right now in the Middle East, certainly mindful as well of the war going on in Ukraine and other places around our planet. And after that, we're going to return to other rule of law issues, those including revisiting some issues we talked about at the conclusion of our program last Saturday. Got many wonderful calls, comments, questions from you in the 6 or 7 days since our discussion about the 14th Amendment and also about false electors here in the state of Wisconsin. I'm going to respond to some of those, try to codify what we chatted about a little bit last week, and then talk about some additional issues related to those two important rule of law issues. Again, the 14th Amendment, Section 3, whether or not it prevents a certain present candidate for the presidency of the United States of America from serving in that capacity and even appearing on ballots around the states of this country. And then also chatting again about false electors. What is the status of false electors around the country, including Michigan, including in Fulton County, Georgia, and right here in Wisconsin? We're going to talk about that once again. And then various updates on a number of different trials, 4 different events, 4 different judicial proceedings also involving our former president in various states and various jurisdictions around the country. I'm going to chat about two recent cases, the initiation of new charges against two members of our United States Congress just this past year, and what that means not only for them, of course, to the rule of law, in addition, but also what that means in terms of the future of the operation of the Congress and the attempts in our United States Congress to address the many issues we have pending before us in our nation, the areas of immigration and violence involving guns, the areas of health care and all sorts of things out there that should be on the agenda of our Congress. What do those kinds of things do? The charging of sitting members of the Congress, one in the Senate, one in the House of Representatives. Why is it important to do that? And what lessons should we take from those particular charges coming out just this week, again, from the U.S. Department of Justice? And then in our second principal hour this morning, as always, we're going to spend some time talking about the United States Supreme Court. As in previous weeks of this month, the United States Supreme Court was active just this past week in hearing arguments on three very important cases, one in particular having to do, yes, that's right, with voting rights coming out of South Carolina, a question of gerrymandering and politics in the Supreme Court wrestling with whether or not those kinds of things are justiciable, whether or not political considerations and racial considerations mixed up together in determinations made by the South Carolina legislature should in fact be the subject of a decision coming out of the Supreme Court in June. Alabama case also, as we know, pending. Other cases out there likewise impacting not only the implications, the application of the Voting Rights Act, but also voting for Americans across our nation. An aggressive but achievable agenda this morning. Thank you once again for joining me this hour and hopefully also next as we talk about these and many other issues before us today. I'll also indicate before we get started this morning substantively that there is an important program note, which is that next Saturday, the 21st of October, I'm going to be broadcasting again live from the Civic Media Studios in Madison at 3535 University Avenue, right there in downtown Madison. A first experience for me broadcasting from that particular location. Excited to do it. I know we've got many, many listeners from the Madison area, many listeners throughout the state of Wisconsin. Excited to be coming to you from that specific location next Saturday. Again, as always, the format will be the same. Reviewing the important questions and issues and news stories in law, government, and justice in America. But as always, taking your questions, your comments at that time, as we do this morning. Once again, that phone number, 844-967-2789. Also text us on the Civic Media app, Civic Media online folders, and get your comments and questions to us throughout this morning and also future broadcasts. Let me begin by talking about the issue which is on all of our minds this morning, and that is war on our planet. As I indicated, we know well that the war in Ukraine continues. The wars in other places of conflict throughout our globe, throughout the nations of our communities, overseas, and right now, especially focused upon the Middle East and the war that is underway, having begun last week, just about at the same time that we were on the air, involving Hamas and the State of Israel. It is a little after 5 o'clock on the evening on Saturday in Israel, in Gaza, in the Palestinian area right now in the Middle East. What do we know about what's happening just this morning? Well, we know that there was some information provided earlier in the day there in Israel and in Gaza that arrangements have been made for Americans to go to what's called the Rafah border, bordering on the nation of Egypt. And yes, that's where Gaza is. It has a border not only, of course, with Israel, but also with the country of Egypt. And there were plans made to permit Americans to cross that border, presumably to safety, into the Egyptian nation. Unclear as of a couple of hours ago whether that was successful or not. But the Rafah border, again, focusing on this huge issue related to a very small geographic area, Gaza, probably about the size of the city of Philadelphia, a very small area, obviously millions of people in that small area, which is also a part of the humanitarian crisis caused by the conflict now underway there. We also know that there are Israeli tanks right now who are at the border, the northern border of Gaza, likely going to be rolling in sometime soon. this is going to be a full-scale war. It already is. More people, in addition to the thousands of people, Israelis and Palestinians who have already lost their lives in this conflict, more people are going to die. Huge numbers of casualties, as we know. Huge numbers of injuries as a result of this displacement of people and human tragedy, as we often discuss. In my own experience, having spent 2 years in the nation, the Republic of Iraq, 2006-2008, I was a part of a contingent sent there by the U.S. Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of State, and yes, indeed, the U.S. Department of Defense. All of us combined in an attempt to try to establish the rule of law in the wake of the Saddam Hussein leadership and autocracy there. That happening in 2006 to 2008. Among the reasons that I went there was to get a sense of war in our times. And certainly it was very instructive to me. I'm reminded once again of it when I see images coming out of Gaza, coming out of Israel, coming out of Ukraine, other places in the face of our planet also involved in horrific conflict. Conflict by its very nature of this sort, war by its very nature, is the ultimate form of destruction. When I was in Iraq, we often spent time attempting to reestablish the basic trappings of civilization there in the midst of a war going on, in the midst of this very destruction that affects not only lives of people, first and foremost, their livelihoods, huge numbers of injuries, not just to military troops there at the time, coalition forces, Iraqi forces, and the forces who would stop the progress moving forward in the rule of law area, but also, of course, destruction of the fundamental trappings of the way in which people live. We're talking about basic access to medical care, health care, access to education, training, and growth, access to culture, obviously, as well, access to all those things that we envision when we think about commerce and transportation, the ways in which we deal with our lives on a daily basis, the ways in which we deal with each other. All of those not only stopped, but affirmatively destroyed by war. This is plainly advocacy, which I know all of you embrace, for some sort of negotiated resolution to what is admittedly a crisis, an unresolved crisis, for well over 70 years now. The problems have gone on for a very, very long period of time. Proposals for things like a two-state solution continue to be proposed during the course of discussions, both here in the United States and certainly around the world. Today's violence in the Middle East, the war that is now underway, likely to even get worse in the next 24 to 48 hours, calls upon us all once again to figure out a way to identify the mechanisms, as difficult and challenging as they are, to try to resolve this, to ensure that we don't have even more losses of life and that the basic trappings of the rule of law can be promoted. War is the ultimate destruction of the rule of law and justice and notions of government. That was one of the great lessons I pulled from my time in Iraq, the 2 years, 2006 to 2008. It is the destruction of life, the trappings of the prosperity that we think about when it comes to the human existence that we all enjoy and should be pursuing on a regular basis. What was happening, obviously, in Iraq is different from what's going on in Israel and in other places around our country, but that fundamental notion, once again, that war is the ultimate destructive force when it comes to establishing and maintaining rule of law, something we need to keep in mind as we go ahead this morning. When we come back right after this first break, we're going to talk more about a couple of issues we chatted about last week, including here in America, the application of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, and also fake electors right here on Morning Cannolis.
Hey, I'm Emily from Weikert Realtors Lake Point in Madison. Your home, your property, your decision. At Weikert Realtors Lake Point, we'll guide you every step of the way, whether you're buying or selling a home or exploring commercial property. Your dream is within reach. You'll find our realtors love what they do, and more importantly, we think it's fun helping our clients achieve their goals. Who wouldn't want to do that every day? Give me a call at 608-721-8002. Weikert Realtors Lake Point, 2045 Atwood Avenue. Find more info at weikert-lakepoint.com.
Have you noticed bad behavior has become normalized at interscholastic athletic events? Some fans seem angry. They lack civility toward one another. Some even get aggressive and unruly. Time out! What is going on? This has to stop. Let's not forget, school sports aren't just about winning. And they're definitely not an excuse to take your frustrations out on the official or the opponent. They're about teaching lessons like perseverance, respect, and empathy, so students can learn and grow as people, not just as players. We all have a role to play in setting a good example for our students and teaching them these important values. So fans, it's time to step up your game and behave positively at interscholastic athletic events in Wisconsin.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Scattered rain showers likely this afternoon, otherwise cloudy skies. Daytime highs approaching 54, northeast winds 15 to 20 miles an hour. Chance for scattered rain showers tonight, lows around 42, cloudy skies. Overcast again tomorrow, high of 52. Temps below average Monday and Tuesday with highs in the mid-50s. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 46 degrees.
Broadcasting to Waukesha at 101.1 FM. Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM. This is The Shaw, WAUK.
And we are back here on Morning Cannolis. Thank you for joining me this morning in our discussion of some major stories this past week and pending in the contemporary consideration of what's going on in courts and in judicial proceedings around our nation. Let's get right into some of those. Last week, we began our discussion of the 14th Amendment, this issue that many of you have followed up with me on this past week. The 14th Amendment, Section 3, we don't always think of the 14th Amendment as being the focus of qualifications to run for office in America. We know that the 14th Amendment, Section 1, passed in the wake of the Civil War, July 9th of 1868, ratified by a sufficient number of states, basically says that there will be no one who was born or naturalized in the United States subject to the jurisdiction of our nation or any place in the United States of America shall be denied the privileges and immunities of citizenship and deprived of any life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And likewise, the 14th Amendment, Section 1, prohibits denial to any person within the jurisdiction of equal protection of the laws. That fundamental affirmation that the recently emancipated slaves at that period of time are entitled to all the rights and the privileges of citizenship, that's Section 1 of Amendment 14 of the United States Constitution. Section 3, again, often forgotten in our history. Why? Because it applied specifically to this time period after the Civil War, when you could identify, Abraham Lincoln could, and frankly, others in our government could identify with particularity the folks who were involved in the insurrection. Abraham Lincoln, of course, died before he saw the actual implementation of the 14th Amendment, but his contemplation was that the slaves would, in fact, not only be emancipated, restored to, brought to full citizenship in our nation, And then also that those people who had engaged in the insurrection, which was and remains the Civil War in the United States of America, would not be permitted to serve in positions of responsibility and authority as a result of the insurrection in which they had engaged. Abraham Lincoln also anticipated that, again, even though the 14th Amendment not ratified until after his assassination. What does Section 3 of Article Amendment 14 of the Constitution say? It says this: no person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state, who having previously taken an oath as member of Congress or as an officer of the United States, that's the all-important language here, or as a member of any state legislature, or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States, any person who's done that, taken that oath of office, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. That's the prohibition of Section 3 of Amendment 14 to the United States Constitution, prohibiting someone who's taken that oath to the Constitution of the United States of America, who is also then engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, prohibited from serving in those official capacities, plainly applicable to federal law enforcement, federal executive positions, federal legislative positions, federal judicial positions as well, involving the work and the activities of the United States of America. Well, why is that important? Well, again, as we have chatted, began to chat last week, soliciting and receiving many of your questions and comments in follow-up to that discussion. What does the 14th Amendment mean today? Well, an awful lot of focus on whether or not Donald Trump, the former president of the United States of America, should be prohibited from not only serving as the president of the United States of America, if indeed he is elected to that position in 2024, about 13 months or so from now, but also even prevented from being on the ballot in the various states around the nation in which he plainly would be appearing absent some change in the law, absent some decision by state officials to keep him off the ballot. And that's where it gets to the 14th Amendment. An awful lot of people out there, including some very learned academics, we talked about them last broadcast, who proposed that the 14th Amendment is self-executing, that by its very nature, just as it was in the wake of the Civil War, everyone knew who the insurrectionists were, and they were prevented then from serving in any official capacity. Their argument is that today, in 2023, 2024 as well, the 14th Amendment remains self-executing by its very nature. By its very nature, cannot have anyone serving in those capacities, in federal capacities of official responsibility, cannot be serving in the roles in any federal position around the country, cannot be appearing on any ballots. The 14th Amendment, by virtue of its very language, self-executing, keeping people off the ballot if they have previously engaged in the insurrection about which the 14th Amendment speaks. And so what's been going on around the country, as we chatted last time, many of you called to follow up on the specifics and asking for information. Lawsuits are being filed right now, and they fall generally into a major category and then a second category, which we'll also talk about. Some of you asked about this in particular. Many, many lawsuits in various states around the nation, New Hampshire, other places, Minnesota, Michigan, and Colorado in particular. Many, many cases now being filed seeking what's called declaratory judgment. Seeking a declaratory judgment that Donald Trump should not be permitted to show up on the ballots for the presidency in those states. A declaration is what the request is, that when it comes to creating those ballots in those states and presumably others where these cases are also pending, Donald Trump's name should not appear as a candidate for the presidency because, the argument goes, he engaged in insurrection and therefore should not appear on those ballots in violation of the prohibitions of set forth in the 14th Amendment, preventing him from being on those ballots. So what has happened? Those cases are proceeding apace. And in particular, just this past week in Colorado, we had a particularly important decision made by a judge there. A group of Colorado voters there, they're backed by a fairly liberal watchdog group, are arguing against the 14th Amendment bars Donald Trump from Colorado's ballot, keeps him off the ballot in that state. And the amendment, of course, as I indicated, prohibits people from holding office in Colorado and other places around the country if they've engaged in this insurrection or rebellion against the United States of America. Now, Donald Trump and his lawyers in these various jurisdictions, including in Colorado, have said that the lawsuit is an attempt to infringe on his First Amendment rights and prohibit him from appearing, obviously, on the ballots, from serving in this capacity and from pursuing his interest in becoming the next president of the United States of America. They sought to dismiss the claim under Colorado law that aims to protect people from frivolous lawsuits and for exercising that right. When we come back, I'll tell you what happened in Colorado.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
On The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
CBS News Special Report. Palestinians are fleeing Gaza ahead of a planned Israeli ground offensive. This woman says she just wants her life back.
We hope that we will have our simple rights, at least have a home and a house.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, through an interpreter, says Israel is targeting Hamas for its attack against Israel.
We are striking our enemies with an unprecedented power. I emphasize, it's just the beginning. Our enemies have just begun to pay the price. I can't divulge what comes next, but I can tell you, it's just the beginning.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is hoping the conflict can be contained.
It's vitally important, and I know that our countries agree, that we work together to make sure that, to the best of our ability, this conflict does not spread to other places on other fronts.
Secretary Blinken speaking in Saudi Arabia. CBS News Special Report. I'm Linda Kenyon.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. The northern and southern tips are still filling in, but most people in Waukesha are now using Lake Michigan water. The transition started Monday, and the map on the city's website shows the almost complete coverage. Reports of discoloration and odor are few. Wisconsin legislators passed a resolution condemning the recent Hamas attacks in Israel, while three Milwaukee Democrats chose to abstain. Representative Darren Madison expressed a need for a resolution endorsing both Israeli sovereignty and the conclusion of the Palestinian occupation. Representative Ryan Clancy questioned the resolution's use of the terms barbaric and evil to describe the attacks. Representative Lakeisha Myers suggested in a social media post that Israel may also be involved in acts of terrorism. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
It's homecoming week at Carroll University, and after two tough football games on the road, the Pioneers want to get back to winning, hosting the Blue Jays of Elmhurst University this Saturday, October 14th. You can catch all of the action live with Don and Johnny, pregame at 12:30 and kickoff at 1 p.m. The Pios welcoming the Blue Jays live this Saturday afternoon on the Shaw, WAUK Radio 540 AM, 101.1 FM, and the Civic Media app.
Have you noticed bad behavior has become normalized at interscholastic athletic events? Some fans seem angry. They lack civility toward one another. Some even get aggressive and unruly. Time out! What is going on? This has to stop. Let's not forget, school sports aren't just about winning. And they're definitely not an excuse to take your frustrations out on the official or the opponent. They're about teaching lessons like perseverance, respect, and empathy, so students can learn and grow as people, not just as players. We all have a role to play in setting a good example for our students and teaching them these important values. So fans, it's time to step up your game and behave positively at interscholastic athletic events in Wisconsin.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
You are never far away from your favorite local radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app, and we invite you to get social with us by following our network's Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook pages. Want even more? CivicMedia.us.
We are back here at Morning Cannolis, spending some time in response to your questions and comments this past week about our introductory comments last week about the 14th Amendment, and then also going to be chatting in just a few moments about fake electors in our nation and here in the state of Wisconsin. Right before the break, talking about litigation that has been initiated in many states around the nation to invoke the 14th Amendment prohibition of people who engaged in insurrectionist activity from serving in official capacities in the federal government, a lawsuit pending in the state of Colorado, some significant action this past week. This action, obviously opposed by the former president, Donald Trump, and his lawyers. But this past week, without ruling on the merits of the case in particular before her, Denver District Court Judge Sarah Wallace ruled just on Wednesday. And then she said this: in short, it is in the public's interest that only qualified and faithful candidates be allowed to seek public office. and that an exemption to the law, and she's talking about this SLAPP law that prohibits the filing and the initiation and the pursuit of frivolous litigation, an exception to that be applied. She says it goes without saying that in the abstract, ensuring that only constitutionally qualified candidates can seek to hold the highest office in the country, particularly when the disqualification sought is based on allegations of insurrection against the very government over which the candidate seeks to preside, seeks to enforce an important right which confers a significant benefit to the public. That, all the things said by the district court judge in Colorado, her name's Sarah Wallace, once again. A trial on that lawsuit, an actual trial, is scheduled to begin at the end of this month. And though the litigation will continue, the court is going to be focusing in particular, the first time in our nation, really wrestling with this issue of whether or not the 14th Amendment prohibits, at least in the state of Colorado, from Donald Trump's name appearing on the ballot. We'll keep monitoring that as we will in other cases around the country. The second kind of lawsuit that is potentially out there is this. It goes back to the issue of the self-executing nature, arguably, of the 14th Amendment. Many people say that you don't need lawsuits like this, declaring, in fact, that the 14th Amendment means what it says and says what it means. You can simply have people like secretaries of state, local clerks, making the decision not to include Donald Trump's name on the ballot. And if they make that decision, again, self-executing as an independent decision, not coming out necessarily of a judicial ruling of the sort that presumably will come from Colorado, these other places around the country, That action in of itself will almost certainly prompt the second kind of lawsuit, which is a challenge to that decision, seeking to have the decision to keep Donald Trump off the ballot, having that reversed, having a judge come in and say, no, the 14th Amendment does not, in fact, require that decision be made in the way that the local appointed or elected official has made that decision. And that, of course, because, as we know from other cases, including one pending before the Supreme Court just this previous term, we know that it's the states, it's not the federal government, it's the states who make these decisions about the terms and conditions and the trappings of elections. That's all done by state officials. Again, so if a state official comes forward and says, you know what, I believe that the 14th Amendment is self-executing, I believe that the former president engaged in insurrection related to January 6th and other matters both before and after that, and for that reason, I'm going to keep his name off the ballot, that could also prompt many, many kinds of lawsuits challenging that decision, seeking to enjoin that official from doing what she or he is proposing to do. So a lot of litigation coming up down the road. Many of you asked also about precedent. And again, we haven't had a lot of opportunity until this recent time to understand what the 14th Amendment really means. The Supreme Court has never weighed in on it. We know, again, in the wake of the Civil War, that it was viewed as self-executing. Why? Because it was fairly clear who the insurrectionists were, those people who advanced the position of the Confederacy. Those folks were identified fairly clearly as having taken an oath of office previously and now violated that oath. It was self-executing at that time. However, we do have some precedent fairly recently, not in front of the Supreme Court, not in front of appeals courts, but we know that a federal district court judge in New Mexico, and we talked about this previously, barred Otero County Commissioner and a Cowboys for Trump founder, Coe Griffin, that's his name, citing this clause in the 14th Amendment. This federal judge in Mexico, and invoking the 14th Amendment, prevented Griffin from serving in a capacity, there a state capacity. He had previously convicted of a misdemeanor trespass charge brought by the federal government, again, in the U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. And the federal judge in the case in New Mexico found that that was sufficient to support a finding that he had engaged, that is, Coe Griffin, had engaged in insurrection that kept him off the ballot. It was the first time in 150 years that that provision had been used affirmatively to disqualify somebody, an official, and the first time that a court had ruled that the events of January 6th were, in fact, an insurrection. Coe Griffin had been arrested on January 8th of 2021. Federal misdemeanor charges, as I just indicated, trespassing related to the January 6th insurrection. He was convicted of that charge in March 22nd, sentenced on June 17th, 14 days time served, and ordered to pay restitution of $500, a $3,000 fine, and complete some community service. He was kept off the ballot of the commissioner's position there in Otero County by virtue of an invocation of the 14th Amendment by a federal judge who said the 14th Amendment prohibits someone who engages in insurrection from appearing on the ballot and certainly serving in that capacity. So we know that there's at least that precedent out there for doing this. We will continue to monitor not only your questions and comments about this, taking those all the time as these cases move forward in both categories, both those seeking declaratory judgment that the 14th Amendment does prohibit the former president from appearing on the ballot, and those that may come if indeed a state official says, I'm keeping Donald Trump's name off the ballot. Certainly the Trump team of lawyers, Donald Trump, will challenge those decisions again in court, arguing that the 14th Amendment does not, in fact, prohibit him from serving in that capacity. The presidency does not, in fact, prohibit him from appearing on the ballots of the particular states in which officials may make that decision. So lots of fascinating civics issues here this morning. We appreciate very much your 14th Amendment questions and comments of this past week, and we'll talk more about those cases as they proceed apace in the weeks and months ahead, knowing that there need to be some resolutions of these issues in the coming months before the 2024 election and even the 2024 primaries coming up in the early part of the coming year. We also spent some time at the end of the last broadcast talking about another aspect, likewise, of the January 6th insurrection, the attempt to undermine votes of Americans in Wisconsin, but also in other states around the country. We know about those facts very well. We talked last week about the request, the entreaty by our governor, Tony Evers, saying that somebody should be held accountable. There has to be accountability, Tony Evers said, when it came to these individuals who made the decision on January 14th of 2020 to sit down in our Wisconsin Capitol and execute these documents, purporting to be appropriate electors from the state of Wisconsin, purporting to be electors who were supporting the presidency, the candidacy of Donald Trump, and purporting to put themselves in the position of the actual electors who are meeting down the hall to execute the actual real documents at that time going off to Washington, D.C. And so we talked last week about the particular events and circumstances of those events on December 14th of 2020 right here in the state of Wisconsin. Again, an awful lot of argument, an awful lot of discussion about whether or not the electors here in the state of Wisconsin, 10 individuals who did that, who purported to represent themselves as actual electors when in fact they were not only preparing these documents, but sending them off to Washington, D.C., the archives, and to the Congress of the United States of America to be counted as actual votes. They maintain, of course, in the event that the actual electors from Wisconsin, presumably from other states as well, were found to be not the case. None of that happened, of course, and we know what happened on January 6th after the attempted coup, after the attempted insurrection there in Washington, D.C. The slate of electors, including the proper electors from Wisconsin, were counted by the vice president, by the Speaker of the House of Representatives. But along the way, the question remains, did those people who attempted to undermine, to overthrow the voters here in the state of Wisconsin, the proper electoral count, should they be charged with violations of state law or federal law? And we know as well from our previous discussions that there have been some precedent out there already. We know in the state of Michigan, across Lake Michigan, in the state of Michigan, the attorney general there, her name is Dana Nessel, has in fact brought state charges against the fake electors in that state who did almost precisely what the fake electors here in the state of Wisconsin did. And she has brought those felony charges against those individuals who engage in that kind of conduct. There, that case proceeding to trial. We know as well that in the omnibus indictment that's returned by the indicting grand jury in Fulton County there in Georgia, the case now overseen now in the trial court in Fulton County there in the state court in Georgia, that Fannie Willis has also charged a number of the fake state electors there too. Same kinds of things with attempting to undermine the proper votes, the electoral college votes being presented to the Congress properly by purporting to be in this capacity when in fact their positions were fraudulent. She's brought those charges as well. And those are proceeding apace. And the question is, what about the other states, also the so-called swing states, including cases involving the Wisconsin electors? And we chatted last time about the fact that there is a statutory basis for bringing those criminal charges here in the state of Wisconsin. We identified a number of those, among other things, exercising powers as if legally constituted, assuming to act as a public officer, all kinds of things under Wisconsin law that could be brought against those fake electors, including attempts to be parties of a crime, attempt to commit any of those offenses also under Wisconsin statute. So some of you have appropriately sent me questions and comments about the issues that I began to discuss last week. I'm going to go into them a little bit more detail here. What about the legitimacy of state prosecutions in Michigan, in Georgia, potentially here in the state of Wisconsin, when we know as well that Jack Smith, who is the special counsel handling the federal case involving January 6th. He has brought this singular indictment already, charging the defendant, Donald Trump, with violations of the federal law, four counts in particular, attempting to undermine the election. We also know that the Department of Justice is similarly looking at fake electors around the nation, presumably in Michigan, presumably in Georgia, and presumably here in the state of Wisconsin. Lisa Monaco, the deputy attorney general, a long time ago said that the Department of Justice is looking at those matters as well. Now, it may well be that Jack Smith will at some point indict more cases, almost certainly will do so. We have talked at great length about the unindicted co-conspirators identified in that federal indictment. Jack Smith will also, presumably, through the grand jury process, indict those individuals as well. There may be yet a third tranche of defendants out there similarly indicted by a grand jury for their involvement in January 6th. And there might be a third or fourth tranche of defendants, including fake electors, around the country. And so those people are plainly already on files and plainly on lists, not only in the states in which they committed those state crimes, but presumably have already gotten the attention of the federal government as well. So that's where we stand right now. And what about the fake electors here in the state of Wisconsin? Some people have questioned whether state prosecutions of these fake electors here in the state of Wisconsin and other states are appropriate, whether they're necessary, even desirable, especially, again, given this reporting that the federal government is also looking at the same kind of conduct, investigating the scheme to undermine the election federally, and the tendrils that go back into the states, including the state of Wisconsin. That scheme, of course, involves multiple players, but it also involves, according to all the official reporting out there, the reporting reliable, involving these fake electors as a part of the overall scheme to undermine the election of Joe Biden and to establish that Donald Trump should, in fact, have been the president of the United States of America. Some comments about that, which I began to talk about last week. Appreciate very much your thoughts and questions articulated in the past week about whether or not this need for so-called parallel proceedings between Wisconsin and a federal tribunal at some point, whether that's appropriate, desirable, necessary. When we come back after the break, I'm going to talk more about those potential state law violations and the appropriateness of going ahead with those, even if there is a federal charge or a set of federal charges down the road, and the reasons why there are good social policy reasons for doing both. Stay with us for that discussion right after this break here on Morning Cannolis.
Yeah, I'm looking at the pages right now.
Thomas's translation company just lost its only two Spanish speakers. Tomorrow. Without the right replacements, he'll be en problemas.
Yeah, we'll have those ready. Tonight's gonna be a late one.
Indeed can help him hire great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. With Indeed Instant Match, we immediately show you quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed meet your sponsored job description. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get $75 towards your first sponsored job. Terms and conditions apply.
Have you noticed bad behavior has become normalized at interscholastic athletic events? Some fans seem angry. They lack civility toward one another. Some even get aggressive and unruly. Time out! What is going on? This has to stop. Let's not forget, school sports aren't just about winning.
and they're definitely not an excuse to take your frustrations out on the official or the opponent. They're about teaching lessons like perseverance, respect, and empathy, so students can learn and grow as people, not just as players. We all have a role to play in setting a good example for our students and teaching them these important values. So fans, it's time to step up your game and behave positively at Interscholastic Athletic Events in Wisconsin.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw.
Scattered rain showers likely this afternoon, otherwise cloudy skies. High temperatures reach up to 54, northeasterly winds 15 to 20 miles an hour. Cloudy skies tonight, chance for scattered showers, lows level off around 42. Cloudy skies expected tomorrow, 52. Temps below average Monday and Tuesday with highs in the mid-50s. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 46 degrees.
Keeping Southeast Wisconsin informed, engaged, and entertained. This is The Shaw.
540 AM and 101.1 FM. WAUK.
We are back here in Morning Cannolis talking about the policy reasons, the strategic reasons, the rule of law reasons for charging here in the state of Wisconsin the 10 fake electors who attempted to undermine the election here in the state of Wisconsin and around the nation, talking about the potential for state law violations that we talked about previously, those giving rise to charges against those individuals, giving the state courts jurisdiction here. The state courts do, in fact, an important role to play under these kinds of circumstances, especially when under these kinds of facts, these kinds of events, those investigations and the facts upon which the charges could be built could prioritize different actors, levels of prosecution, all sorts of things that can be vindicated in the state system. The federal system simply does not. State prosecutors might be more inclined to focus on some local offenders, which plainly are identified among the fake electors here. Federal counterparts, including Jack Smith, we don't know exactly what he's going to do, might target other national players. He's already done at least that when it comes to the indictment against Donald Trump. He's going to identify other players out there. This two-pronged approach, number one, is not at all illegal. There is nothing strategically inappropriate about it. In fact, it happens all the time when it comes to parallel or state and federal proceedings that are proceeding forward in the same path, if you will. Adopting this two-pronged approach, if you will, actually serves to not only advance the rule of law here in the state of Wisconsin, but also does some other important things when it comes to supporting the actual federal prosecution down the road. One of the things that can happen, we see this as well in prosecutions around the country. If indeed there's a state prosecution, it is entirely possible that some of those defendants identified in the state prosecution could agree to cooperate with the government, the state government, the federal government, in identifying what they know about other people also involved. And so there's actually an advantage to charging state actors here in the state of Wisconsin for their state violations of law that might be helpful not only in future state prosecutions, but especially as Jack Smith continues down his long list of defendants who might potentially be charged in the federal system. Plainly, the attorney general in the state of Wisconsin has the not only statutory authority to do this, he's got the prosecution authority to do this. We know as well that these particular state interests, the vindicating of the state interests that I've talked about, can't be done by anyone else aside from the principal law enforcement authority here in the state of Wisconsin. Michigan can't do it. Fani Willis in the state of Georgia can't do it. And yes, Jack Smith can do it at the federal level. But again, there is some significant reason to prosecute state actors for their violations here in state law, vindicating these state violations that have been perpetrated by those individuals. Nothing about parallel proceedings is prevented by the law. Nothing about it is prevented by a strategically wise approach to these issues, addressing all those people who attempted to engage in the undermining of our election back in 2020, 2021 in particular. All those things supported by the law and supported by the strategy that is undertaken routinely when federal and state elections are addressed, and the interests of state officials, the interests of state citizens in ensuring that their laws are enforced are also enforced at the federal level. We know as well from our last week discussion that as a part of this, it's an interesting, more than just an interesting footnote, that in March of 2022, in connection with the review by the Wisconsin Election Commission of a complaint about this very issue, that is this administrative body having before it the decision about whether or not there had been a violation of state elections law. We know at that time that the Department of Justice, under the auspices of our present attorney general, had concluded that the fake electors weren't trying to fool the Senate, the United States Senate, but instead were legitimately trying to preserve Donald Trump's legal standing. That was a ruling and an opinion issued by our attorney general back in March of 2022. A lot of that subject to an awful lot of questioning given the facts and circumstances of what happened on December 14th of 2020. But that opinion, again presented to the Elections Commission at that time, said this: the memorandum concludes that the complaint that is against the fake electors does not raise a reasonable suspicion that the respondents violated Wisconsin law. They cast their votes even though the canvas did not reflect a Trump victor in order to preserve the opportunity for votes to be counted if a court challenge found that Trump received the majority of votes. That analysis, again, from the attorney general back in March of 20, indicating that at least in connection with state election laws, it was his position that they had violated nothing. And that may be a significant hurdle, a significant burden when it comes to filing state prosecutions under these other theories that I've identified. It is out there as a part of the decision-making process coming out of our attorney general's office, again, about 18 months or so ago. All of this, however, not prevented from going ahead and filing those state prosecutions against those individuals. It is a matter for the attorney general to take up and do on behalf of vindicating the interests of people in the state of Wisconsin for these violations of state law. All of that, again, appreciating tremendously your interest in that particular issue, 14th Amendment, and also, again, this morning, state electors in the state of Wisconsin and throughout our nation. I promised at the start that we would also talk in this hour and into next hour about a variety of other things having to do with many of the lawsuits, criminal and civil, pending against the former president. We're going to do that. We're going to begin now with some of that, continue that into our second hour, and then spend a fair amount of time talking about the Supreme Court into our second hour here on Morning Cannolis. This past week, we know that the civil lawsuit pending against the former president, members of his family, members of the Trump Organization, continued in the Manhattan State Court. This is a civil proceeding. It is not a criminal proceeding. Brought by who? Brought by the Attorney General of the State of New York. Her name is Letitia James. She has brought charges, again, in a way that underscores the significant role of state attorneys general in vindicating state interests, the state legitimate interest in ensuring that the state laws are supported and that people who violate them are brought to justice. She brought this lawsuit seeking about $250 million in damages against the Trump Organization, prohibiting, part of her request, the Trump individuals, and including Donald Trump himself, his sons, from ever again participating in any sort of corporate entity when she's got responsibility for oversight and supervision, and also seeking other remedies that are before a fellow named Justice or Judge Engoron, we've talked about at great length in the past. That particular judge, or justice as they're called in New York, has already found that the fraud took place. He already found that Letitia James had presented on documents and in paper documents in the summary judgment mode the sufficiency of support to find that fraud had taken place. When we come back after the top of the hour, we're going to talk about what happened in the continuing case in front of Judge or Justice Engoron just this past week, testimony and anticipated testimony in the future weeks. Stay with us for that second hour here on Morning Cannolis.
Think you'd like working with us at Civic Media? We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. If you have the right skills to join our team, let's talk. Civic Media is a proud equal opportunity employer committed to diversity and inclusion, along with the growth and development of all current and future employees. If you're interested or are part of an organization who wants to know more, go to our website, civicmedia.us, and click on the Careers tab.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Wisconsin's home for daily conversations about the state's latest headlines and stories.
Weekday mornings from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.